This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support this free service by September 5th and you could win a Mini Cooper S convertible. Go to KCRW.com for details.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
President Bush is on the ground on the Gulf Coast. Has the federal government reacted quickly enough? I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Today on the show, military vehicles move in to control the violence in New Orleans. The Army Corps of Engineers works feverishly to shore up the city's main levee to get the water level down. Meals and other supplies are coming into Mississippi towns, but there are many on the ground along the Gulf Coast asking why it's taken so long to get the first trickle of relief. Later on the show, we rushed to aid the victims of the Asian tsunami last December, and now 40 countries have responded generously to the Gulf Coast catastrophe. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with To the Point from PRI. The first flights since Katrina hit Monday are taking people out of New Orleans. Buses are loading 300 or so people at a time and taking them west to Texas, as the Houston Astrodome will be their home for perhaps several months to come. Thousands of refugees are eating their first hot meals in 5 days, and yet many are still without basic staples, even water and necessary medicine. On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, what foreign countries are doing toward relief for the Gulf Coast. First, this news about the Gulf situation today. Looting continues in New Orleans. Thousands still jam the convention center, and towns on the outskirts of New Orleans, such as Slidell, Louisiana, still report no help whatsoever. We are seeing relief and troops coming into the area today, however, 4 full days after the storm. On both sides of Katrina, pre and post, what could have alleviated much of this suffering? We welcome to the show today Seth Borenstein, who's the national correspondent for Knight Ridder Newspapers. Mr. Borenstein covers environment science and particularly hurricanes, has written 2 books on the subject, and actually reported in an article just yesterday on how this particular disaster brought up the issue of terrorism and how much has been diverted, how many resources diverted toward that effort that could have perhaps been used earlier this week on the Gulf Coast. Mr. Borenstein, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure, Diana.
All right. Let's start, first of all, with the city of New Orleans. You are an expert hurricanes in general. How center of the storm, should we say, has New Orleans always been in the discussion of hurricanes in this country?
New Orleans has always been the worst-case scenario. The people who actually deal with disasters, the professionals, the managers, which unfortunately is not the leadership of the Federal Emergency Management Agency these days, have for decades worried about New Orleans being this hit with a major storm, a Category 3, 4, or 5. I have been to hurricane conferences in New Orleans where they go on and on about how this is just a major disaster waiting to happen. No one can say they never thought of this. In the 1990s, when James Lee Witt, who was a professional emergency manager, was director of FEMA, they had plans for what to do if a major hurricane hits New Orleans. One of the plans was to have hospital ships nearby, not in the storm path, but in places like Texas, as long, you know, someplace where you know it's safe, and so they can be there a day or so later. The hospital ship Comfort is leaving Baltimore today, 5 days later.
How long does that take, by the way, that trip?
I think they're talking several days.
Not till midweek, perhaps.
Right.
So when you paint that picture, and I assume it's simply the geography that New Orleans lies below sea level.
Right, New Orleans is, if you wanted to design a place badly for hurricanes, you couldn't design any worse.
Yeah, it's the worst.
You have it below sea level, it's next to a giant lake, and you have a levee system that is only designed to withstand Category 3 storms.
Now, talk to us about these levees, because we are also reading all week about, you know, how they've been in very dire need of shoring up, and the funding just has not been there.
The funding has been cut. Everything hurricane-related has been cut, especially in New Orleans over the last several years. And there has been work that has not been done on the levees. Now, the commanding general of the Army Corps of Engineers yesterday said this is it wouldn't have mattered, and it had nothing to do with the breaches that happened, because this was only designed to go for Category 3, and this was a Category 4 bordering on Category 5 storm. So this is a much bigger storm than they designed for, which, of course, begs the question, why didn't you design for something bigger? But there's a saying at FEMA, and I've been told this by several FEMA people and disaster people, there are only two kinds of levees, those that have failed and those that will fail.
Mm-hmm.
So you cannot really rely on levees to protect you all the time.
Yeah, and now at this point, what is being done? I understand, you know, we're very focused on the refugees and the evacuation, but the Army Corps of Engineers is working around the clock to try to stem the tide, so to speak, and get those levees shored up. Is that a pretty difficult task when you consider the water table right now?
Well, it's a very difficult task. I'm getting a sense that they may have they may be close to fixing, you know, at least getting over the hump. It's you know, it's an engineering task. It's easy to fix things when it's dry, and even if they do fix it, you got to remember all the water's on the other side. How are you going to get that water out? Another plan that had been in the '90s was to have a barge near New Orleans pre-deployed with pumps.
What happened to all these plans you're talking about with nearby ships, nearby rescue ships, nearby barges? Have we all just figured, well, what are the chances? The hurricanes come in year after year. They do hit the Gulf, but they haven't slammed New Orleans yet. It's not going to happen. Is that what the mathematics played against it?
No, because the mathematics play in favor of it. What played against it was purely Osama bin Laden. This is just purely a function of September 11th changing the focus of the federal government. Now, the federal government is the Bush administration, and to be honest, they did start changing at the moment they got in, but it dramatically changed afterwards. FEMA, which had been a standalone near cabinet, not cabinet level agency, but near cabinet level agency, was folded in to the Department of Homeland Security.
Yes, and of course that focus is the war on terror. I tell you what, Mr. Bornstein,
sure.
You've got so much to add to our conversation today. Would you stick with us just
sure.
through this break? I appreciate that. We'll be back in just a moment with To the Point from PRI.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with To the Point. Katrina devastated the Gulf Coast on Sunday night into Monday. Today, Friday, the area is still very much in crisis. The overwhelming question continues to be, who's in charge? All week, reporters and citizens on the ground in Mississippi, Alabama, and especially in New Orleans, have lamented that there's been virtually no presence of police, military, or FEMA personnel. President Bush is touring the area today, talking to governors, mayors, rescue crews. Many of those people have been asking why it took the federal government so long to begin relief efforts on a large scale. Have federal funds needed for this disaster been diverted into the war on terror? Some of our guests today will say definitely so. Has the Gulf Coast hurricane triggered a hurricane in Washington? Some of our guests will agree with that as well. Before we turn to our first guest for this segment, let's listen to President Bush from just a short while ago responding to reporters about the federal response to the hurricane.
So you talk about fixing what's wrong, and you talk about the results not being acceptable, but there are a lot of people wondering why you weren't fixing the problems yesterday or the day before, and why the richest country on earth can't get food and water to those people that need it.
The levees broke on Tuesday in New Orleans. On Wednesday and Thursday, we started evacuating people. A lot of people have left that city. A lot of people have been pulled out on buses. It's... You know, I am satisfied with the response. I'm not satisfied with all the results. They start pulling people off roofs immediately. They start rallying. We started rallying choppers to get people off rooftops, start saving lives. I mean, thousands of people's lives have been saved immediately, and that's good news. This is one of the worst storms in our nation's history. New Orleans got hit by two storms, one the hurricane and then the flood. And it's going to take a monumental effort to continue moving forward, but we will.
We welcome to the show now Benny Thompson, who's the Democratic congressman from Mississippi, ranking member on the House's Committee on Homeland Security. Congressman Thompson, thank you for being with us, and can you respond to that particular response of Mr. Bush's?
Well, I think the president's absolutely correct when he says he's not satisfied with the results. But he differed a little bit from what he said earlier today when he said he was satisfied with the response. Well, there's no way you can be satisfied with the response and not satisfied with the results, because when you're still responding, and obviously you're responding 3-4, and in this instance, 5 days late. So there is a question of inadequacy of response that goes to the fact of whether or not we were actually prepared to respond in the first place, or whether or not we have stretched our resources beyond our capacity to respond.
Yes, because, you know, the people's question, as we've been interviewing people all week here on this program, bring up the fact that what if we had had a terrorist attack in New Orleans? You know, how quickly, within minutes, within hours, we would have had troops there from perhaps Fort Bragg and from the 82nd Airborne in North Carolina.
Yeah.
And so again, you know, it's not to put the question to you directly, but to sort of, through you, put the question to the federal government, why so slow?
Well, thank you, and that's the question. There's no doubt in my mind that the response had to be a federal response that includes a military response.
Sure, and but now we're going, it's really on the Fed level, and let's stay there in terms of Congress people in general. Congress people, local leaders, we've felt that there's a lack of leadership all week long.
Well, the voices have been silent. I think part of what you saw was a real hope that everybody could pull together and do the best job possible. But as time wore on, we saw that the best job possible was not being done. And I think that's why you're hearing voices of criticism in the process of this whole effort, that it was not adequate. And I think it doesn't take from the men and women who've been there from day one. It just said that we did not provide them all the resources necessary to make this happen. And because of that, we are in a very, very difficult position, put a lot of people in harm's way from this disaster simply because we did not get to them. The pictures we see in many instances of people walking the street, there's no question in my mind that if the response had been adequate, many of those pictures we saw would not have taken place.
Hmm. You know, we wonder if perhaps it's a matter of personalities as well. I think all week long the suffering people of New Orleans and other areas down on the Gulf Coast were looking for a Giuliani type to lead them. And even the former mayor of New York, Ed Koch, said today that in the New York Times that President Bush flying at quite a distance, you know, over the area in Air Force One, a distance and a speed, didn't do much compared to him having landed there Tuesday, Wednesday, and showing his deep sympathy for the people in person.
Well absolutely. And saying, as Commander-in-Chief, I'm going to direct whatever resources I have under my direction to this effort. And now here we are, day five, finally getting a commitment of those resources. But my district now is being inundated from people who didn't get the resources in time, and so they had to, on their own, strike out, many of them running out of gas along the way, relatives having to come pick them up on the highway,
mm-hmm.
so that we can't, in fact, that's the only way they could get to safety. So that response continues to be less than adequate. The coordination that we have required that agency to have just has not worked to the extent that the designers of the process intended it to work.
Congressman Thompson, I mentioned before that you're the ranking member on the House's Committee on Homeland Security, so you're very familiar with, you know, how much Homeland Security is beefed up. And as Seth Bornstein, who's going to come back with us in a minute, mentioned before, in beefing up the Department of Homeland Security, FEMA has been weakened. Just in the bigger sort of picture, has this been the right tactic for us over the past few years?
Well, you know, to be honest with you, we have been so focused as a country in this administration on this terrorist threat that we have basically moved resources to that direction, and we have basically put FEMA in a second-tier status, when basically a domestic preparedness response mission is clearly FEMA's mandate. And because you don't provide the resources necessary or the direction at the top, obviously people are still thinking 9/11. Well, you know, disasters happen in many forms.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we have with this disaster is clearly a vulnerability that in some instances has been exacerbated by the fact that our response has been less than adequate.
I want to bring Seth Bornstein back into the conversation now, a hurricane expert, national correspondent for Knight Ridder Newspapers. Mr. Bornstein, Stein, you're hearing our conversation with Benny mm-hmm. Thompson. Some response from you.
Well, actually, can I ask some questions for the congressman here?
You can ask, and I'll ask him.
Okay, because I'm wondering right now about we're spending about $15 to $20 on terrorism preparedness inside the U.S. compared to every dollar we spend on natural disaster preparedness. And why does the Congress keep approving this type of budgets, and does he think that is a problem? And the other thing I would like to ask the Congressman.
Well, let's make it simple. Sure. Let's go right back to Congressman Thompson.
Well, I think, as you know, the leadership in both bodies basically dictate the ultimate outcome of those numbers. The president submits budget. We respond to that up or down. And in the end, because of where we are at this point, I think you will see a continued direction toward the domestic preparedness for terrorism rather than preparedness for disasters.
Even after this past week?
Well, you know, I look at the budgets that we're dealing with right now. They still do not reflect a commitment beyond what has been in the past.
Would you go so far as to say, on a very, you know, direct dollar countable basis, that money has been diverted from disaster relief to the war in Iraq?
Well, you know, I can say that the Corps of Engineers budget that has been submitted by the president each year has always been much lower, sometimes zero, and Congress has had to put the money back in. It's a constant. Struggle that we struggle with. I have 280 miles of the river as my western border in my district.
Mm-hmm.
And flood control is essential to the livelihood of my constituents. And so I'm a strong proponent of it. But every year we have to fight to get some resources to continue from a maintenance standpoint projects that we've already completed. Bringing on new projects has been an untenable position given the budgetary constraints that we get put under.
Seth Bornstein, you had another question for Mr. Yeah. Thompson, and I guess we just heard the answer basically out of Washington, which is those ratio of dollars is not about to change.
Well, also, one of the things that Homeland Security has that other federal agencies don't have is they change budget spending levels between different subdivisions and parts of the agencies. They have to get congressional approval. In Homeland Security, you don't. And we are hearing all sorts of money being moved from FEMA, from disaster preparedness, to things like more, you know, Homeland Security that's not disaster-oriented, more terrorism preparedness, airport security. Do you have a problem with the money being shifted without congressional approval and the shifting of money in itself within the department itself?
Mr. Thompson?
I do, but, you know, when you're not in charge, in many instances, you can't dictate the direction. We have tried, from a policy standpoint, to put an authorization bill before this Congress that addressed a number of these issues, but, you know, we lost it on a partisan vote. And I think that as long as whoever's in charge take the position that they do, you will see the same thing continue.
Well, now that we're into the political dimension of this discussion, let's go to Richard Wolff, the senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Mr. Wolff, thank you very much for your time, as you gave us yesterday. Can we say a political hurricane's about to hit President Bush?
Well, it's a cliche, but yes, and it's already begun. And I don't think it's just confined to President Bush. This is a storm that is going to affect every elected official, whoever has responsibility for dealing with this crisis and also for preparing for it in the first place.
Well, you know, as I said in the beginning, there is the pre and the post, and now we're dealing with the post, and there are so many people, you know, all week who have stood in tears at the edge of the convention center in New Orleans at the Superdome, and we keep hearing the word out of Washington from Department of Homeland Security, saying that the troops are there, the National Guard is there, plenty of FEMA is there, but agreed the news is selective. Perhaps we didn't see all the pictures, but certainly the pictures we saw and the reports we heard from the citizens on the ground was that there was no relief, basically nothing until today.
Right. And actually, what we're also seeing today is a distinct change in the message coming out of White House officials up to and including the president himself. They're no longer talking about help being on the way in terms of tons of material flowing towards these people.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more personal. The president has expressed his frustration with the response so far. But, you know, you're seeing some of the more emotional response that we frankly haven't seen from anyone in Washington for the last couple of days.
No, we haven't. And I guess I'm trying to set the scene of what this is going to mean politically as, you know, we come through this next year.
Yeah, obviously, this is we're heading towards congressional midterm elections,
mm-hmm.
and there is an already nervousness among Republicans who obviously control Congress about the state of their standing in the polls and the president's standing. Now, much of that for the last year, according to the White House anyway, has been driven down not by Iraq but by gas prices. Of course, what we've seen now is a spike in gas prices. So, if you hold to that theory, then the president and the Republican fortunes do not look good in terms of the polls moving forward, but that's just gas prices. Of course, the pictures we have seen over the last few days have been searing. They're unforgettable, and it's extremely rare in any country at any time that these pictures can get broadcast without having a political impact.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Wolff, we'll be back to you after the break. And before we take a quick break, perhaps Mr. Thompson, Congressman Thompson, you could give us the last 30 seconds in terms of President Bush's future vis-a-vis this disaster.
Well, I think he's the commander in chief. He's the only person with the authority vested in his position to make a difference. Him coming is important, but I think more important is the fact that he recognized that the response was inadequate and that something more had to be done.
All right. We thank you very much for being with us today. That's the Democratic Congressman from Mississippi, Benny Thompson, and good luck with all your constituents down your way.
Thank you.
We'll be back in a minute with more of To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney today on To the Point. We're trying to discern what the communication failures, other problems have been post-Hurricane Katrina, and who should have been leading the immediate response effort. Richard Wolff's on the line with us now, the senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Mr. Wolff, let's delve in, if we can, it's a dicey subject, but to the racial dimension. You know, the faces that we've seen all week are black. We understand they're poor people who could not evacuate. What does this say symbolically?
Well, what we're seeing here is obviously the nation's divisions, racial, social, economic, are brought to the surface again, as they have done from time to time in violent ways in the past, obviously through race riots. But you know, this is an open wound that has come to the surface here, and we had a lot of anger expressing that from the Congressional Black Caucus in Washington today. Again, the start of this sort of political storm that is really going to take over in Washington.
And there were many voices that we heard this week, the poor and often African Americans who felt they were abandoned, and there was no leadership there from the mayor to the governor to the president. Again, bringing it back to politics, does President Bush's leadership in light of recent polls and the waning popularity for the Iraq War, is this going to be pretty hurtful to him and his particular cabinet?
Well, as I said before, I think it's hurtful to all incumbents. But ultimately, as the commander-in-chief, he does have control over the single organization in the United States that have the assets and the ability to respond to this kind of crisis, whether it's helicopters, emergency rations, or hospital ships. You know, the response has not been timely, and there is a real question, as has been expressed by emergency officials on the ground, about who is in control. To this date, there is a mixed control here. There's National Guard in there operating under the control of the Joint Task Force, but they're also operating under the nominal control of the Louisiana governor. So it's mixed, and there has been a conscious decision by the administration not to invoke federal powers to take control of this. You know, there will be people who are going to try and look at this again and say, was that adequate? Should it have risen to the federal level? And should the president have taken control earlier? It certainly seems from the flow of material today that it was possible to get things through if those resources, those amphibious trucks, had been in place.
Mm-hmm. And Seth Bornstein, if you'd come back with us now, the national correspondent for Knight Ridder newspapers, has covered hurricanes and written books about them for many, many years now. Mr. Bornstein, the governor of Louisiana, Ms. Blanco, has said during this last week in great frustration that we learned from 9/11 that the bureaucratic lines of communication have been terribly inefficient. And now it seems that that's precisely what's happened here. In New Orleans specifically this week?
Well, it's not just the lines of communication. It's just the whole thing is just poorly designed and poorly run. I mean, there you've got the person in charge of Federal Emergency Management Agency has never been a disaster official until he was politically appointed in 2001. He wasn't a professional. You've got people who don't know the issues, who one of the first things they did was cancel something called Project Impact to prepare for things like hurricanes and earthquakes. And these were exactly the communications issues were some of the things that they were looking at, who to communicate, chain of command. There is no chain of command.
And I guess that brings me to the question of, again, everyone's frustration of not bringing in active military this week. It's different. There's flooding, and there are people dying and floating in the rivers, and there's actual anarchy on the streets. You know, why were we not prepared to go beyond National Guard and beyond waiting for the decisions of FEMA and just bring in active military?
Because you have to actually plan for that in advance. That's something you plan, not after. These are things. It's like a Boy Scout. I'm a Cub Scout leader.
Uh-huh.
You don't do these things after they happen and say, "Ooh, what should I do? Who do I talk to?" These are things you have to set up, because it's not easy to activate the military, the National Guard, on a moment's notice. What in the past has been done, they've been put on ready reserve and told, okay, if this happens as we expect, we're going to activate you, get ready to go, get to this place nearby, and once the storm winds are gone, you'll be there.
We had a guest on the show yesterday, Dr. Ivor van Heerden, who's deals with water contamination and all kinds of things out of New Orleans, and he laid out a number of very concrete plans for preparedness in case this happened, but very few of them were followed. Is that true?
Well, there were. I mean, many of the things weren't followed. And one thing that's very interesting, and I put this in the story that was in Thursday's papers, is they found one of the top disaster officials in FEMA, who has since left, a man named Eric Tolbert. He was in charge of disaster response.
Mm-hmm.
He scrimped together about $250,000 to $500,000 to do a New Orleans-specific hurricane PAM. It was just almost like what we're seeing. It was a drill in June, July of 2004. That was year one. Year two was supposed to be, well, what have we learned from this, and how can we fix all the problems we've learned? Year two, which is supposed to be now, was canceled. There are no action reports from this to learn from. In other words, and he said this actually may have cost some lives. They had these type of plans and canceled them.
You know, we're talking so much now about the government plans, and perhaps that includes military plans as well. But a number of people have expressed on this show as well the curiosity about private industry right there. You know, with the oil companies and all of their helicopters and planes, et cetera, and other places around the country. Why have there not been just automatic drop-ins of water and food and an inundation of help?
Because, one, they're looking for someone to coordinate them. One of the big problems you can have is everyone acting on their own. That's a disaster after the disaster. After Hurricane Andrew, there was a giant, almost dump, garbage-like dump of winter coats. People were sent everything they could think of down there, including winter coats to Florida in the summer. You know, why would someone do that? Well, they're trying to help, but it's an uncoordinated response of private industry, private individuals sending whatever they can without federal coordination is just an unmitigated disaster.
Yeah, I want to go back to Richard Wolff for one last comment from him, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Mr. Wolff, one of your colleagues, Howard Fineman, begs the question, you know, are we capable of facing two wars at one time?
It's interesting the parallel with Hurricane Andrew, because people were asking the same question. Was the president too focused on Iraq and not focused enough on the homeland? Of course, that President Bush was running for re-election, and this one has already won re-election. I don't think there's a question so much about the resources, the number of National Guard, because there are enough troops out there. The question is the attention of the decision-makers capable of dealing with two crises at once?
So it's not the manpower, it's the focus.
It's the decision makers, it's the leadership.
Okay. Richard Wolff, we thank you for all the time you've given us today.
Thank you.
Senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. I want to go back to Seth Bornstein. Mr. Bornstein, let's talk about the evacuation and the hundreds of refugees, thousands of refugees.
Hundreds of thousands.
Hundreds of thousands of refugees. So let's talk about, first of all, the planned Superdome, and now I understand even the Astrodome has gotten to full capacity.
Right.
Was that always a plan, those stadiums?
No, the Superdome was supposed to be a evacuation site of last resort, not, you know, not we're going to send them there first. The Astrodome is certainly flying by their seat of the pants. We've got all these people. What you've got to do, I mean, they're just trying to find places now. The key is to get people out, not put them up somewhere in New Orleans. In Florida, which was a disaster during Hurricane Andrew, but now the state of Florida has the best emergency management in the nation, most likely. I mean, just you watch how well the state did after the four hurricanes last year.
Yes.
What they do now with hurricanes is when a hurricane is approaching, you know, the people can afford it, leave on their own. Then they send the county buses, the bus systems, to the beaches and to the areas where they know people don't have money to pick them up and do what everyone else is doing, which is get the hell out.
Yeah.
So that's what you've got to do. But that's also the state and county, or in Louisiana's situation, parish responsibility. And one thing to think about here is Louisiana is not exactly immune from problems with their emergency management. Their emergency management department had three top officials indicted a few months ago, having to do with some questionable money use after Hurricane Ivan. So they were already in disarray before the storm.
Yes. You know, I don't know if Dr. Van Heerden is a colleague of yours.
No.
Okay. Well, he's the director of the Center for Study of Public Health Impact of Hurricanes right there in Louisiana at LSU. And he was saying saying to us yesterday that, you know, typical in any other country, what they would do is set up a proper refugee camp. We're not used to having tent cities in our country, but much better than these ideas of the Superdome is go somewhere up close to Baton Rouge, onto drier ground, set up a huge tent city. And what his point is that you not only provide, of course, the staples, you've got to have food and water and bathroom facilities, et cetera, but you start getting schooling going again. You have therapists working. You have a socialization process. Has that been any of the pre-planning with hurricanes and specifically with New Orleans?
Well, I don't know if New Orleans pre-planned that. I mean, other places do. I mean, and in Andrew, after Andrew, we had a giant tent city. But the trouble with places like tent cities is, one, you can't do that in New Orleans because you're underwater. That's
mm-hmm.
one of the major problems with New Orleans. Other places can just put up tents, giant tent cities. New Orleans, you can't because you're going to be underwater.
All right. Well, I thank you very much, Mr. Bornstein. I want to turn to Dan Meese now. He's the president of Nadel Architects in Los Angeles, actually the design architect of the Staples Center here in L.A., Safeco Field in Seattle, Miller Park in Milwaukee, a number of parks around the city. Mr. Meese, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Let's talk about the capacity and the nature of a stadium. I mean, my God, the stories have been horrific. People needing to defecate on the floors because the toilets are overrun, no showers available, air conditioning not working. I assume that these stadia were never meant to house this number of people for a number of days.
Well, yeah, I think that's one of the key points is that they're not intended to house people consecutive days. I mean, certainly they're set up to house more people, frankly, than are in the Superdome now for a particular event. And, you know, I think the real problem with the Superdome is that it's not able to function as it was designed to function because many of the services aren't working, like electricity and air conditioning and sewers and things like that.
And what about the Astrodome? And I mentioned a moment ago that we're just getting a note that already too full to accept more refugees. And we've heard that maybe, and of course it could go longer than this, but these people, is it some 25,000 may be there until December? What is the capability of a structure like that? Again, flowing water, bathroom stalls, et cetera, working for that number of people for that long?
Well, again, the systems in a building, in the Astrodome, for example, that hasn't suffered the damage that the Superdome has, the systems are there to handle it, things like the restrooms, flowing water. What they're not designed to do is to be homes for people. There's not places to lay down. They're seats. They're there to hold events of a few hours at a time. And in the case of the Astrodome, if they can be prepared for it, have people there that are manning the building and operating it, you know, it takes hundreds of people a day to operate the building for these events. The Superdome didn't seem to have that. My first impression was that it was only going to be sheltered during the storm because it would structurally withstand the wind, and I don't think there was ever an intent that it was supposed to provide, you know, a home for people who had lost their homes.
Sure. What is the capacity? I mean, the seating capacity of the Astrodome is something like 85, 90,000 people?
Yeah, I don't think it's quite that high. I don't have it.
Well, that's all right. But I guess I'm.
But it's in that neighborhood, yeah.
But I'm getting to the point that area is not usable because, as you say, it's just seats. So, you know, I guess the real question is this the right way to go, or should we be building the tent city right now?
Well, yeah, I think the previous guest mentioned that the problem with the tent city is just that there's no large dry area to set it up.
Set it up in Texas.
Yeah, exactly. You could take them somewhere else. That's why my first reaction when I saw that people were being evacuated from the Superdome to the Astrodome was surprised, because that's never been, you know, other than you see people in a much smaller event housed in a gymnasium or something, these buildings aren't typically thought of as being places of refuge, certainly for, you know, consecutive days.
Well, and it's almost, you know, the image we have. I mean, these are strong, the best athletes in the world who play in these stadia. So it's a real deconstruct to see them now being refugee camps, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I mean, you know, I mean, I've designed a lot of these buildings, and I love attending events. But I mean, anybody can tell you that after sitting in a seat like this for 3 hours, you're ready to go home. And so the idea that you would actually have to sleep there, you know, the real viability of these buildings as massive shelters like this are limited to the area of the field itself, because it's really that and a few concourses where you could actually put things like cots and have people be able to lie down.
That's right. Unless you go to the outside grounds as well.
Right. Right. And the Astrodome, again, maybe from that perspective, because they tend to have large areas of parking, maybe they're good areas for tent cities in other situations where you don't have the water. But again, I think that the particular tragedy of the Superdome is that it was initially thought as a place of refuge from the storm itself, but wasn't in any way prepared to handle, you know, an influx of refugees that would have to operate on a daily basis. I'm sure it must be horrible.
Must be horrible. Once you see something for the first time, it then sparks the imagination. Do people like you, architects who build these kinds of stadia, sort of start talking like, well, maybe we should think of this in the future. The next one we build should have some of this refugee take-in in mind.
Well, you know, I guess I initially wondered about that, but I think that there will be such a horror left in people's minds about this experience that it reminds you that these buildings really aren't set up for that. Certainly, we could think about having them as refuge from that initial storm or tornado or earthquake that could provide, and you know, they have large storage areas and things like that, maybe a very temporary shelter from the storm, if you will. But I think that what this sparks in my imagination, and I think most architects, is, you know, is there a better solution to that very instant temporary housing that could be provided on a mass scale when you see something like the tsunamis or this tragedy?
Yeah. Well, it's going to be up to you architects' creative minds to come up with this, isn't it?
Yeah, well, and it's interesting that, you know, the whole world's gone through some major events in this way in the last few years, and I'm sure I certainly saw some response to that after the tsunami, and I know it's had me thinking about it in this tragedy, that there must be a creative way to provide something that you could airlift in and provide a very quick temporary solution to something like this.
And have you heard, by the way, now that the Astrodome is full, and I hear that there are another 25,000 people, at least the state of Texas has said they'd be willing to take them in San Antonio, will that be a sports stadium as well?
I heard that this morning about San Antonio, and there is a dome there, mm-hmm. although I wasn't exactly clear if that's what they were intending to do. I had also heard that, you know, ultimately the New Orleans Saints won't be able to use the Superdome, and that the dome in San Antonio would be the potential home for them. So I wonder if, again, when you hear that the Astrodome's full, obviously it has a much larger capacity than 15,000 people or something that I've heard. I think what they mean is that they're not going to put themselves in the same position that the Superdome turned out to be, and they're trying to accommodate people comfortably. So you're probably limited, again, to, you know, how many cots can you put on the field, how many people do we have to operate the building and make this a real comfortable situation, not something as tragic as what happened in New Orleans.
Yes, crunch the numbers on people. Well, Dan Meese, we thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
President of Nadel Architects in Los Angeles. And Mr. Meese mentions disasters worldwide and what's going to be developed, looking forward there. And as a matter of fact, we're going to talk about international aid to the Katrina disaster in just a moment. I want to thank our other guests for this segment first, though. Benny Thompson, Democratic congressman from Mississippi, was with us. And I should say that we had scheduled a Republican congressman from Louisiana for the show today, too. But at the last moment, being busy down there himself, he couldn't join us. Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine, was here. And Seth Borenstein, the national correspondent for Knight Ridder newspapers, was with us, too. On Reporter's Notebook, in just a minute, as I said, foreign countries rush to our aid. We'll be right back with more of The Point from PRI.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. As of this morning, 39 countries have pledged cash, personnel, and goods in offering relief in the Katrina hurricane catastrophe. Several countries known for strained relations with the U.S. government, even, most notably Cuba and Venezuela, have offered their help. Joining us now is Kevin Kennedy, who's the Director of Coordination and Response Division of the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs at the United Nations. Mr. Kennedy, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Dana, for having us.
All right. First of all, am I up to date on 39 countries, or are they even more at this point?
There may be more. That's our latest count. I think our count was like 37, but of course, information is moving quickly. I wouldn't be surprised if it's more than that now.
How does the process work when a country wants to deliver and needs to delineate what they've got, whether it be outright cash? Who do they report to at the UN? How is it collected? How is it distributed?
Well, the countries country offers of assistance is really bilateral between one country to another country. There is no obligation to report that to the UN, but we generally tend to find out in the larger humanitarian effort. And they'll make that offer up, I think, in this case, with U.S. to the State Department.
I mentioned Cuba and Venezuela, and we've Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, much in the news lately.
Sure.
A lot of anti-U.S. sentiments in that country. So it's heartening to see that when it comes down to the human level, that all politics step aside.
Yeah, no, I think so. And I think we've seen this in relief efforts worldwide on whatever political stance countries have where, you know, certainly the United States has helped many countries whose politics they're not in favor of, and it works that way, I think, in the main, and that's the way it should work.
Sure. What is the UN specifically doing? Have they offered particular assistance, and has their offer been accepted?
Now, we have prepared or on standby to offer assistance. We're ready to provide, I think, firstly, personnel, Diana. We have a lot of staff. Of course, we respond to natural disasters worldwide every week. And we have hundreds of staff trained in sanitation, water, coordination, making assessments, logistics, and so forth. We have about 200 people on standby that are ready to come to the region if called upon, along with a whole variety of emergency supplies, whether it be water items like purification tablets, bladders, tents, the normal range of emergency equipment. We have been making this offer to the United States. We have been in discussions with them. I think we'll probably know something more later in the day. My sense is, I would add that there's really nothing worse than uncoordinated help going into an emergency, having worked in any number of them myself, and things have to be sort of put in order to make sure you don't arrive and just make the situation worse rather than better.
You were a coordinator, Mr. Kennedy, of the disaster relief for the tsunami in South Asia just some 7-8 months ago. Can you possibly compare the two situations?
I did, and then in the tsunami, I worked at the New York end, coordinating from here. My deputy was in Aceh, and my boss was the regional coordinator, but I was certainly involved in it. I guess a couple of comparisons. One would be, I think where it's the same, this is one of those emergencies that is of overwhelming magnitude. For whatever reason, good, bad, or indifferent, it's an emergency that people could not quite envision in advance.
Mm-hmm.
Even people's worst expectations have been exceeded, I think, in the main. And I think one of the lessons from the tsunami is, in the early days there, in that last week of December, you know, we kept saying to ourselves, we know this is big. We don't know how big it is, but we know it's bigger than what we're probably thinking it is. So in that respect, the terms of the response, when you look at over a million displaced people, at the level of destruction, when the U.S. and authorities there begin to make their assessments, or are making their assessments, you probably, once you make your assessment, you should double it, and that's probably what you're going to need to try to meet the demand.
Double, my gosh. Daniel Lack is with us as well, the BBC correspondent formerly in Southeast Asia, now in Biloxi, Mississippi, helping out down there. Mr. Lack, you covered the tsunami as well. Thank you, first of all, for being with us. What's your comparison now that you're right there on the ground?
Well, I guess the first thing to say is that, you know, the scope of the two disasters is similar. I mean, I've covered many hurricanes in the United States as well, and,
mm-hmm.
and they've all been local events, mostly in Florida. You go there and you see tragedy, but it's confined to a local area. You know, it's a small swathe of territory. This one is along an entire coast, three states, one of America's great cities. That reminds me of the tsunami, if you like, because when it hit Sri Lanka, you know, the entire lower southern half of the coast, right around to the east and northeast side, completely devastated. In India, you had 1,000 miles or more of coastline. Those may be greater distances, but in terms of the communities affected, the size of it, the challenge to, you know, the humanitarian workers, the media, the governments involved, everything, we're seeing the same thing here.
And what about the comparison, if you can, in response? You know, our impression when we were here during that horrible tragedy of the tsunami was that response was on the scene, even though it was so widespread over so many different oceans and shores. But the response was immediate, and the criticism this week has been that the response has been slow.
Yeah, the response to international tragedy these days, to catastrophes like the tsunami, is pretty good. I mean, I think humanitarian workers are the great heroes of the modern age, not just the United Nations, but in the private NGOs like Oxfam, ActionAid, Médecins Sans Frontières from France, many, many, many others. These people are geared up to swinging into action, you know, literally at a moment's notice. They get word of a crisis. They get to the region, you know, as soon as it looks like it's going to be even partway serious. They're out in the field within hours of getting to the airport in the capital. They're setting up their first trauma camps for triage of victims, you know, very soon after they get there.
But then
saying that here, I think the problem was a lot of the people who would be responding were affected as well. America first has to respond. You know, this is America. People are expected to respond, doctors and so on in the area. Well, they were in their homes, or they'd been evacuated, or they were, you know, traumatized by what they'd been through. They didn't have people coming to their airport and offering help right away.
Okay. And so you're not so critical of the response as many other corners have been this week.
Well, I think the criticism might be more on a political level in that it seems to have taken people in Washington a long time to realize just how serious this is. Now, you know, that we'll leave it to the commentators why that might be. But I didn't get a sense for a couple of days that this was going to be the main event for American politics, for American government. Not until probably Wednesday or so did it become plain that President Bush, that his administration, they were going to concentrate on this in a way that no other issue was going to captivate them. When a tragedy happens in a third world country, you know that it's decimating resources across the system. Here we were hearing, well, America can cope. It's got lots of money. Well, yes, America has lots of money, but now we're hearing about the impact on the economy, much bigger than we might have expected.
All right.
The same with government.
Daniel Lack, I thank you so much, and good luck with your work down in Biloxi.
Thank you.
We thank Kevin Kennedy for being with us as well. The producers of To the Point are Francis Anderton, Katie Cooper, Christian Bordahl, Ileana Justice, Jonah King, and Sharon Rembaum. The managing producer is Karen Radsner. Special thanks to Laura Moglen. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. The technical director is Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Diana Nyad. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW, Santa Monica, and Public Radio International.